It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Darrell Connor. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Wisconsinites battling Parkinson's disease are using boxing to stay in shape and build new friendships. We'll learn more from one of the trainers in the Rock Steady program.
Now, Governor Walker signed lame duck legislation today in Green Bay as he prepares to leave office in January. Among the bills he signed was a controversial change that strips some executive powers from incoming Democratic Governor Tony Evers. Though Walker and other state Republicans say the powers of the governor will effectively be the same.
Speaking at a news conference today, Walker said that these bills were necessary to keep the state government transparent and stable moving forward. He also highlighted his 8-year legacy as governor and a Kimberly-Clark deal that was made official yesterday.
Sean Johnson is the Capitol Bureau Chief for Wisconsin Public Radio News. Sean, welcome back.
Hey, Rob.
So these bills signed were passed in this extraordinary session of the legislature. There had been hints and speculation that the governor might use line item veto power on some part of it. Did he?
Hints from the governor himself, and he did not. He said today that there was only one of them that he could have used it on because only one of them was an appropriation bill, you know, that spent money. And he didn't want to change that bill. There were other bills that perhaps he was looking at, but he just decided to sign all three in their entirety.
Now, there are arguments about how big a deal these changes are. Republicans say these are small changes to the power of the governor. Democrats saying these are pretty big changes. We'll leave it for them to evaluate that. But the powers of Tony Evers as governor will be at some level less than they are for Governor Scott Walker.
Yeah, and they're not theoretical. And if you needed any example on how they are real changes that could have tangible effects on a governor, look at the Kimberly-Clark deal that Governor Scott Walker reached yesterday. This is, you know, there was as an effort in the state legislature to pass a Kimberly-Clark incentive package, and it went nowhere in the state Senate. A number of Republicans had problems with it. Democrats said that, you know, that they were never consulted, so they weren't going to sign on. And so we all thought that was dead, that there was going to be no way for the state to offer some kind of an incentive to Kimberly Clark. But Governor Scott Walker did, through these powers that he has or had as of yesterday, to reach an agreement like this with the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. So they were able to reach a $28 million deal with Kimberly Clark. Under the bill that Governor Scott Walker signed today, one of them, Tony Evers, would be unable to do that without first going to the legislature to get their okay. And maybe that would happen, but there was a bill in the legislature that, again, did not pass this year.
And Governor Walker, in his press conference today, was trying to sell the case that, hey, Tony Evers will be as much of a governor as I am. They had a thing that looked like a Venn diagram. People have pointed out it didn't really make sense as a Venn diagram. But the gist was Scott Walker has powers, Tony Evers has powers, they both have the line item veto, not a big change, is the case that they're trying to sell here.
So Tony Evers' biggest powers as governor, I guess you could say, are still there. He will still have a powerful veto pen. These bills did not affect that. He'll still make, you know, a number of appointments. But to say that he would have the same powers as Governor Walker did during his administration, you know, wouldn't be correct. I mean, the bills that were signed into law today would restrict those powers in a number of ways. I mean, the Kimberly-Clark bill is one example. Another is that, you know, Tony Evers campaigned extensively on getting Wisconsin out of a multi-state lawsuit that seeks to end the Affordable Care Act. He could have done that as of, you know, yesterday, but now that's no longer, you know, within his power. He'd have to run that by the legislature first. The legislature supports that lawsuit.
And then some changes that'll affect incoming Attorney General Josh Call as well.
Yeah, Josh Call. And those were whittled down a bit from what Republicans initially proposed when they rolled these bills out. But what the Republicans would be able to do is, if they want to, hire private attorneys more easily, not rely on the Department of Justice so much. And also it would be up to the legislature to decide how to spend settlement money from lawsuits. Right now, that authority rests with the Department of Justice, which Call will lead.
Talking to WPR Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson, looking at the bills signed into law by Governor Walker today from the extraordinary session, many of which limit the powers of incoming Governor Tony Evers and Attorney General-elect Josh Call. By the way, we'll be talking to a couple of key players in these stories. State lawmaker, Republican state lawmaker John Nygren will join us. I believe it's on Monday. And incoming Attorney General-elect Josh Call joins us also next week. Let's talk about some of the response, Sean. Tony Evers, Governor-elect Evers, has been talking about this session as it's been going along. What's his reaction today now to Governor Walker signing these?
His reaction was that Governor Walker had ignored the will of the people. I think that's the phrase that you hear Democrats come back to quite a bit. And Tony Evers did again today. He said he's going to use whatever he can to fight these things. You did hear a stronger reaction from Democratic groups, though, and they're a bit more specific. One Wisconsin Institute and a group led by former Attorney General, U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder, said that they are going to challenge these restrictions that were signed into law today on early voting. So just to take a step back, I mean, Wisconsin had Republican-authored restrictions on early voting that were thrown out by a federal judge in 2016. These would put them back, not identical, but they're similar. And so now you have Democratic groups, Eric Holder's included, saying we're not going to let this stand.
And we're looking at a national reaction to this as well, people comparing Wisconsin to North Carolina, which a couple of years back was going through a similar situation. Michigan is doing some similar things now. We've seen Republican Governor John Kasich of Ohio critical of Governor Walker, his fellow Republican Governor Scott Walker's decision here. This is a story that's being watched nationwide.
It is. It's gotten a lot of attention. The Venn diagram that you alluded to earlier has actually gotten a lot of attention nationally today, too. But John Kasich's interesting because when Kasich and Walker both took office in 2011, Ohio and Wisconsin were following a very similar road. I mean, a bill would pop up in one state and a nearly identical bill would pop up in the other state. They had a version of, you know, what we now know as Act 10 in Wisconsin. In Ohio, their version, you know, voters had a chance to go to the polls and essentially rescind it. But Kasich and Walker, you know, had a long history of being similar governors. And so Kasich's now breaking from that in a pretty public way as he eyes a potential presidential bid.
Now, you mentioned earlier, Sean, the Kimberly-Clark deal, and I wanted to spend at least a couple of minutes on the specifics of that. As you said, long back and forth in the legislature, ultimately they were unable to pass an incentive package. What is in this deal that the governor used his now non-existent powers to work with Weedick, the development corporation, to keep at least some of these Kimberly-Clark jobs in the state?
Yeah, what's in this deal, it would be up to $28 million in state tax credits for Kimberly-Clark for retaining, I believe, 388 jobs in its Cold Spring facility in Wisconsin. And the governor was able to do that through, you know, existing incentives with Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation that until today did not need the legislature's approval. It was interesting when this news came out on the same day, Kimberly-Clark runs a facility in Arkansas and layoff notices went out the day that the Wisconsin deal was announced. So this was a case where you hear about it a lot, where states are kind of competing against each other for these companies. In this case, Wisconsin did come up with a payment, essentially, for Kimberly-Clark. And, you know, Kimberly-Clark announced it was going to stay here. And Arkansas had, you know, worse news.
And how does this deal that the governor has reached compare to what lawmakers are doing? Is there less money involved?
There's less money involved in this one than what lawmakers are doing. Yeah, what the legislature was looking at was the phrase we use is Foxconn-style tax incentives. And that's based on the percentage of tax credits that the company would have gotten for every job that they retained in Wisconsin. So it's less than that as a percentage. So it's not an exact copy of that, but you're talking about tax credits, you know, a state payment to the company based on jobs retained.
So here we are, a rocky start even before the new governor and the very slightly different legislature takes office in January. So what are you watching for now when Democrat Tony Evers actually is no longer governor-elect? He's the governor working with this state legislature that's trimmed at least his powers.
I guess I want to see what we're going to be looking at for a lawsuit. I mean, it sounds like we're going to have one. It sounds like there will be something happening with the early voting restrictions that we know. There's also been talk about some kind of a legal challenge to some of the other restrictions on Tony Evers or Attorney General-elect Josh Call, whether there might be some kind of a separation of powers case that could be made there. I don't know what that would look like. I mean, I haven't heard anyone come out and say, here's how you win that. Here's the very clear-cut violation of separation of powers. They just kind of say there's a case to be made there. So that's what I think we'll watch for next, even before Evers takes office potentially, is where does this go in court?
And is anybody floating, happy ideas like, hey, here's ways, despite our differences, we can work together to do at least some things in the state?
People say that. People say that sometimes. I mean, the last couple of weeks haven't been a great time for that to seem, realistic. There's been, it's been more combative over the past couple of weeks. There are some issues where maybe the Republican legislature and Governor Tony Evers would see eye to eye in the state assembly, for example, on transportation funding. But that seems like a long ways off right now. I mean, the governor-elect will introduce his budget probably in mid-February, and that's when you'll start looking for potential areas of agreement, but also probably a lot of areas where they'll fight.
Sean, thanks as always.
Thanks, Rob.
Sean Johnson is the Capitol Bureau Chief for Wisconsin Public Radio News. He joined us to talk about Governor Walker signing extraordinary session bills today in Green Bay and the latest on a new deal now with the state and Kimberly-Clark.
Right now, Parkinson's disease is a life-changing diagnosis and can make something like learning a new sport seem like a tall order. But thanks to a nationwide program, many people are fighting it back against the disease by taking up boxing.
Rock Steady Boxing, founded in 2006, is aimed at strengthening the muscles and coordination that can deteriorate as the disease progresses. In addition to working up a sweat while hitting the bag, people who take part are also building a community with their fellow athletes.
Patty Batt is a trainer at the Hybrid Athletic Club in Fitchburg, where she heads up the Madison chapter of Rock Steady Boxing, which is the first of its kind in the state. Patty, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much for having me and for featuring our program.
Patty, how did you come to get involved in working with Parkinson's patients and then heading up the Rock Steady class?
In all honesty, I didn't know anyone with Parkinson's in my personal life before 2015, and I happened to stumble across the CBS Morning Show did a segment with Leslie Stahl, and she featured Rock Steady Boxing. Her husband has Parkinson's, and she did a feature on it, and I saw the feature. And at the time, I was a personal trainer at Hybrid, but I had never heard of Rock Steady Boxing, but I saw that piece, and I was like, I've got to get in on this. I knew it was something special, and there's just something about it that drew me to it. So the same day that I saw the segment, I signed up for the training in Indianapolis, and I was there 3 months later doing the training.
Can you give us a sense of what one of the classes is like? What kind of things are happening there?
There's a whole lot happening in our classes. it's a lot of fun. Our class, typically, we start with a warm-up, which consists of stretching, and that can just be core stretching, deep breathing, partner stretching, and then we do a get-to-know-you session, which is actually we do some voice activation. People with Parkinson's have some issues with loudness and being able to have people hear them well. So we do get-to-know-you session, and then we'll do a little bit of a body and a mind warm-up. Sometimes it involves playing some types of games. But then we get into the meat and potatoes of the program. And it's interesting. Every day is different, but we will try to incorporate some high-intensity stations, which focus on all the symptoms that are relative to Parkinson's. So, for example, people with Parkinson's have issues with balance, with hand-eye coordination, the mm-hmm. speed of their movement, agility, focus, mental focus, rhythm. So we will have, let's say, a drill which we are balancing on a beam while doing something with a ball, something that is working two different skills at once, mind and body. We'll do another drill where we happen to be doing the speed bag, which works on hand-eye coordination, rhythm. So it's different every day. We'll also do some sessions that focus on strength work. That might be cable weight machines using hand weights. We do some kind of dancing sometimes. which rhythm and dancing and drumming has all been shown to be helpful in dealing with Parkinson's, so we will incorporate that in our program. And then we spend about 40 to 45 minutes doing actual boxing during the class. It's non-contact boxing, but it's very high-intensity boxing.
Patty, I had a chance to watch some of the videos in your Rocksteady class, and you're not fooling around with these folks. You're pushing them pretty hard. Is that part of the regimen, part of the plan?
It is definitely. It is the key part of the program. Parkinson's is a degenerative neurological disease, and there is no cure, and they haven't found anything other than high-intensity exercise, which has been shown to slow down the progression of the symptoms. Mm-hmm. There's medications that can relieve some of the symptoms temporarily, but high-intensity exercise is the only treatment to date that they have found that's medically proven to slow the progression. So when we do a high-intensity boxing class, you're right, we're not fooling around. They work really hard. We try to keep it where we can have them working at a very high-intensity, high-intense level, but at the same time, we're monitoring people to make sure that they're doing okay, that they're working in a safe zone for themselves. But we also make it fun. So while they're working very high and intense, we're doing fun things. So it doesn't seem so much like work. If you've seen some of the videos, there's a lot of playing around with each other. There's a great sense of community. And we play a lot of games with it. It's a whole lot of fun.
Yeah, I've noticed, that was the other thing I noticed in the video, was that you are having a whole lot of fun. What is it, Patty, about boxing that makes it especially suited for those battling Parkinson's?
Well, I'd say a couple things. One is, like I mentioned a little earlier, the issues that most boxers work on are the same issues that people that have Parkinson's are working on: the balance, the hand-eye coordination, mm-hmm. speed of movement, all those things. But then there is that physical thing about punching a bag. A lot of times I will tell people to envision that bag that they're hitting is Parkinson's. There's a lot of emotion going on with these people, and they're literally fighting for their lives. So when they get in that gym, they're having fun, but they are in an all-out battle. And each and every one of those people who come in are really warriors. So I know when I started boxing, I boxed a little bit before I ever did the Rocksteady boxing program, and it was a real mental, emotional, and physical release for me, and these people get that same thing. So I think it's a really just a big tension reliever. They can let out some of that anxiety and worries that they have, and they can do it with other people. They're doing it with people who are going through the same things that they are. I think the thing that's real important when they're there, they're athletes. They're not defined by their diagnosis at all, and I think people realize that there is so much that they can do when they come in that door.
Patty Batt is a trainer at the Hybrid Athletic Club in Pittsburgh, where she heads up the Madison chapter of Rocksteady Boxing, which is the first of its kind in the state. Now, Patty, obviously the athletes in your class might be dealing with a range of different symptoms. Does a successful workout look different for different people? Do you have separate workout regimens for each person that comes in?
Yes, we do. So we have all different levels of symptoms for people in our class. We'll have people who barely have any noticeable symptoms, maybe a slight tremor, and then you will see people in our classes that have a lot of issues. They're using a gait belt and assistance of a corner person to help them around the gym. As a trainer, it's my job to modify each exercise to work for that person, to keep them safe, but working at a very challenging level at the same time.
Now, the exercise, of course, is important, but beyond that, do you see folks making bonds and forming a sort of community with others in the class?
Absolutely. This is a tight group of people. I know whenever a new boxer comes in or a new person, a prospective person is checking out the program, it's a little overwhelming. You'll see, 30-some people out there. They've all got their gloves, or they're talking, they're sharing information, they're sharing stories. And so at first it seems like a bit much, and then after they spend a little time there, they're in just a big part of that group immediately, and they pulled in. These people do things in our group, in the class, they share information. I'm always amazed that there's this large group of people that have Parkinson's, and they have so much different information that they're not aware of, like what one person is doing for medication, what one person is doing for therapy, or even how they're coping with their disease. So we have a spot where we take our timeouts and where people rest, have water, and people are always chatting, and people are staying after class. People go to movies together. People do a lot of different things, and I see friendships forming, and I think that when you have that common place where you go where people get it, they understand what you're going through, that it is such a comfort to people, and it makes them feel like they belong somewhere. I feel like I'm going on and on about it, but I can't explain it. That's one of my favorite things, is just seeing the bonds that grow between these people and what a community they formed.
Now, Patty, you had the first Rocksteady Boxing program right here in Fitchburg, but there seems to be more forming around the state. Tell us a little bit about that.
Absolutely. So we had the first program in Wisconsin, which I was really excited to do, and we started in May of 2016. I believe since that time, this program keeps growing. I think there are 6 more affiliates in the state of Wisconsin. I believe the closest one would be Rockford. Well, Rockford isn't Wisconsin, but Rockford is close. There's Lake Geneva. There's Oshkosh, Green Bay. And if you go to the Rocksteady Boxing site, they will list all the affiliates. The thing that's kind of amazing is it was founded in 2006. They now have 685 affiliates. They have them in all 50 states and in 14 different countries. So it's really taken off.
Patty, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Absolutely. It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Patty Batt is a personal trainer at the Hybrid Athletic Club in Fitchburg. She's been talking with us about her work training people with Parkinson's disease in the Rocksteady Boxing Program.
Many of us have a tradition of making Christmas cookies every year. They're not always beautiful, depending on who gets the sprinkling job, but they're usually pretty tasty.
On this Food Friday, we're challenging you to try some new kinds of Christmas desserts, one that might even taste good and be pretty. And our guest promises they're not as hard to make as they may look.
Susan Feast has been a pastry chef working in the Madison area for nearly 20 years. She owns and operates a small dessert catering business called Sweet Feast and is a baking instructor in the culinary arts program at Madison College. Susan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Well, before we get into some recipes, how did you first fall in love with baking?
Well, I always loved baking, but I started out as a social worker, and I thought I wanted to be a social worker all my life until I was one, and then and then I realized that was not for me. So I kind of thought about what could I do, and friends were like, oh, you love cooking, you love baking. And that was the first I realized that there was a program through MATC, which was downtown then, a 2-year program for culinary arts. So I went through that, and then I worked at various restaurants in the area back in the old Ovens of Brittany days.
Oh, yeah.
So most of us probably got our start there. And then I was working at L'Etoile as a cook, and the pastry chef left. And so I said, oh, I'll give it a shot. And that's when I realized my love for baking and pastries. So I've been doing that ever since.
Now, I'll say, and I'm probably like a lot of people, there are some things, some desserts I'm happy to bake. I've got my go-tos, my crisps and cobblers and things like that that I think of as easy stuff. And everything else out there I think is too hard for me. But actually, some stuff can look pretty fancy, but be easier than we think to make, right?
That's for sure, yes.
Yeah. So give me some guts here. Give me some inspiration to try something out of my comfort zone with dessert baking before we get to our recipes.
Well, I think the main thing is making sure that you read through your recipe and understand it before you get started. And another important thing is having what we call in the industry mise en place, and that is getting everything set up first. So if you're making cookies, for example, you measure out your flour, your sugar, everything that's going into them, and then it's all right there. So when you're ready to start, you're not running back and forth to the flour bin and back and forth to the refrigerator. And let's see, did I put that baking soda in or didn't I? So it's all right there, and it makes it go really smooth.
That's a great lesson for me, because I've had the, okay, I'm ready for the applesauce in my dessert recipe now, and I pull out the applesauce. Wow, that's been there a long time. It's got mold all over it. I have to switch to a different recipe halfway through.
That's right.
Now, you gave us some recipes, and one thing I noticed on that is you list the weight of the ingredients and the measurement. And I've seen a lot of bakers talk about, you know, if you can get that scale instead of you saying, you know, a cup or two cups or whatever. Why does that make a difference?
Well, because for one thing, like a cup of flour isn't always going to weigh the same. So depending on how you pack it, how you get it out of the bin, it could weigh, it could be like an ounce off on either side. And once you're doubling or tripling, that can make quite a difference. So we say what you can actually measure in a volume cup is, we say mew, M-E-W, milk, eggs, water. So you can measure milk. 8 ounces of milk is going to weigh 8 ounces. But like if you're going to get 8 ounces of, well, we joke around like if a pound of feathers is going to weigh the same as a pound of lead. And that's kind of why to put something in a measuring cup, there's all kinds of space in there that isn't really going to give you a true picture of what you have.
We were talking about holiday baking with Susan Feast. She's a baking instructor in the culinary arts program at Madison College. She owns a catering business called Sweet Feast. And now we're going to get out of our cookie zone for the holidays. You've shared a couple recipes with us. We have them online at wpr.org/foodfriday. You're working with us on some truffles now and a ganache. You've got a basic ganache recipe. I think I'm saying the word right.
You are.
What is ganache?
So ganache, and that's spelled G-A-N-A-C-H-E, ganache. So some people aren't familiar with it, although I think these days more and more people are. Ganache is simply pretty much equal parts cream and chocolate. And depending on the type of chocolate, you may need more cream or more chocolate. But that's really all it is. So with that, you can do so many different things. The way that I would, the best way to do it, I feel, is to heat your cream and then pour it over your chocolate, then let the chocolate sit for 30 seconds, maybe a minute, because you want to make sure that your cream warms and melts the chocolate and not that the chocolate cools the cream down.
Okay, and then we've made this, and it looks like people do a lot of stuff with it. You can use it in place of frosting, it looks like, in desserts like cake, right? But what we're doing today is we're just turning it directly into chocolate truffles. How do we take that ganache, that cream and melted chocolate, and truffleize it?
Okay, so, and you can do lots of different flavors with one batch. So you're going to make your big batch of ganache, and at that point, you can either chill the whole thing, then it becomes a truffle mixture. Like, that's what truffles are, chocolate ganache. Mm-hmm. So you can chill the whole thing and use your scoops to scoop out little balls and roll it in different things. So if you wanted to roll it in, oh, for example, English toffee bits or dried cherries or nuts or such a variety of ways that you could go with it. You could just roll it in there, or you could divide it up, like have individual little bowls. And like in one bowl, this is what I brought in today for you, but in one bowl you can have like some Grand Marnier and chopped candied orange, for example. And then in another bowl, you might put coconut, and in the next bowl, you might put nuts. My favorite is toffee, so that you can either have the toffee mixed into the chocolate or roll it in the toffee or both. But so with this one batch of chocolate, you can make all kinds of different flavors.
And for the listeners out there, you're not seeing my facial reactions, but they're along the lines of, ooh, Grandma Gay, that sounds good, is what you're missing, not seeing the visual here. One thing I love about this idea, you make the one kind of thing, you can do different truffles, and also you've got a basic scone recipe. I love both of these because once you know how to do the basic thing, you can do all kinds of different variations with them. Is that a good lesson for bakers? Like, learn that basic thing and then branch out from there?
That's the whole thing right there. And it's the same with people that are like, oh, I don't like baking because it's such an exact science and I'd rather cook where I can be creative. And it's true that it's an exact science just for your basic formula. But then from there, you can just take it to any level. So scones, for example, you can do sweet scones, you can put berries or dried fruit or lemon peel, basically anything you want for a sweet scone, or you can keep the sugar out and turn it into a savory scone, and there you have another whole wealth of different things that you could do with it.
Now, my imagination is not very good, and I just can't imagine how these truffles would taste. And you've got samples there. Could we dig one out now?
Well,
I'll give it a shot. Yeah, and then you can talk about them a little more while I.
Okay.
Now this is. You really did a lot of different ones. Is that Grand Marnier one there?
Yeah, that is.
All right. Wow. This is. Right, so wait. There. Some of these are dark, and some of these are white. Did you do some of these with white chocolate?
Some is, and also some is milk. So, I made the ganache using all three different chocolates, and then put different things in them. So another thing I wanted to mention, though, with the ganache is that you want to make sure that you test it out first to make sure that you have the right amount of cream. Like if you're doing a milk chocolate, you're probably going to do more like 3-to-1 chocolate to cream. And for white chocolate, even less than that. You want to experiment because different chocolates have different amounts of cocoa butter, so it's not always going to come out the same.
So but with a dark chocolate, I'm going to use more cream, right?
Less.
Less chocolate.
Oh, okay. And then with the milk chocolate, a little bit. No. I'm sorry. Yeah, you have it right.
Okay.
Good. Yeah.
Less with the dark chocolate because there's less the butter in it, or the cocoa butter.
So you use more. We'll start over.
Good.
With the chocolate, basically you're thinking equal parts for dark chocolate.
Okay.
When you get to milk chocolate, you're going to want to go with less cream.
Check.
And white chocolate even less yet.
Now you've brought about 12 here. Did you bring any for anyone else to eat? Because that's just enough for me. No, these are fantastic. And you can find the recipe at WPR.org/Food Friday. Learn how to make your own truffles just in time for maybe a holiday gathering. We're talking to Susan Feast on this edition of Food Friday. She's a pastry chef, owner of a small dessert business called Sweet Feast, and she's been a baking instructor in the culinary arts program at Madison College for almost 20 years.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you have any dessert questions around this holiday time? What's your favorite dessert to make during this season? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
We'll pick up the conversation in just a bit. We've got scones on the way, by the way. You're listening to Central Time.
We're talking with Susan Feast. She's an experienced pastry chef and baking teacher at the Culinary Arts Program at Madison College.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What's your favorite dessert to make or eat during the holiday season? Is there something you've seen maybe in a bakery or a chocolate shop that you'd like to try to replicate on your own? Do you have any questions to ask about baking for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Find some recipes, including that chocolate ganache and some scones and a tart at WPR.org/Food Friday, all provided by our guest. Let's go to your calls now. Eleni is on the line in Middleton. Eleni, hi.
Hi. First of all, I have to say I'm so excited I'm on NPR.
Me too. I'm always excited to be on here. What did you want to ask about, Eleni?
So my family recently went vegan, and I was wondering if there are any non-dairy milks that you can use to make ganache instead of cream.
Ooh, good question. Thanks, Eleni. Any ideas?
Great question, because my husband actually just recently this past year decided to go vegan, which has been a challenge for me. But you can definitely do these using almond milk, soy milk, and basically any other liquid flavoring. You're going to want to change the amounts a little bit, so you can't use as much, like, you can't use as much almond milk as you would cream. But what I suggest you do is put your chocolate in a bowl and just kind of cover it just so that the chocolate is peeking out of the almond milk, and then heat it up the same way, stir it up, add your flavorings, and it's really just as good.
Good luck, Eleni. That sounds great. Yeah, that wouldn't be too hard to pull off, I guess.
And you can use other, like, juices or any type
really?
Of liquid. Cream, of course, is going to be the creamiest and the richest, but you can still make it really well without that.
Eleni, thanks for that call. Good luck in your baking efforts. Thanks for calling 800-642-1234. Susan, we also heard from Eric and Hazel Green. Eric called in saying, asking if you have a recipe for a good fruit cake. Now, you know, fruit cake, you know, is kind of a nemesis for a lot of people. Is there such a thing as a good fruit cake?
I don't have a recipe, although I did just recently make Christmas Stolen, and that was good. I have to say I've never made fruit cake.
Okay. You steer clear of the whole thing.
Pretty much.
All right.
Sorry.
Sorry, Eric, but if you find one, let us know. Now, let's get to, you've got a couple more recipes you shared with us in addition to the truffles and the ganache. A chocolate berry tart, staying on the chocolate theme. And tarts, that's another one I think, that sounds like a lot of work.
Oh, no.
No?
So for that, I thought I would talk about that because you can use the same filling as for the truffles. You make your ganache, you put some of it in and chill it to turn it to truffles. While it's still warm, you pour it into a baked tart shell and let it chill, and now you have like a chocolate truffle tart. So for the crust of that, I included my recipe for shortbread, which is just three ingredients: flour, sugar, butter. And you cream your sugar and butter together, and then you add your flour. It's going to be a little crumbly, so you don't need to roll it out. You don't need to bring it together as a dough. You can just kind of sprinkle your crumbles into your tart pan and press it in there and bake it. And then you'll add your, after you have your baked, cooled tart shell, you can pour your chocolate ganache in. You could also put your favorite berry preserves on the bottom and then pour the chocolate over that and then decorate it with fresh berries on top. It's always a hit, and it really takes nothing to put it together.
And I really like the no roll crust, because that does deter me from making some kinds of pies and tarts. I'm really bad at rolling doughs. It's just a disaster for me, and I need some kind of help with that. But this sounds nice and easy.
Well, yeah, and there's lots of different shortbread recipes and tart recipes, but this is the one I like, that you just kind of sprinkle your crumbles on there. So if you're making it, don't get nervous and think, oh, this isn't coming together, I have to add more liquid, because it's set up that way not to come together, and that allows for you to just press it into place.
We're doing some holiday baking with Susan Feast. She owns a catering business called Sweet Feast. She's a baking instructor in the culinary arts program at Madison College. She's giving us some creative ideas for things we can bake, maybe for a holiday gathering. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Susan, people are into scones these days more and more, it seems like. This would be a fine thing for, like, you know, maybe Christmas morning or New Year's morning, whatever. Just a nice treat to start the day with. How hard are scones to make?
Again, they're easy. Like with anything, as long as you know the procedure and you're familiar with your recipe and your ingredients, you can put it together so quickly. And the nice thing about scones is that you can do several different things. You can make your dough and have it all set to go except for adding the cream at the end, and have it bagged, almost like buying off of the shelf a packaged scone mix, except that you made it yourself. So you have your flour, your butter, your sugar, all the dry ingredients together marked. When you're ready to make it, you just pull that out, dump it in the bowl, toss your cream in there, and then you're going to pat it into like a little disc and cut them. And that's basically what your dough is. So you can also make the whole thing, cut them, have them frozen, and pull them out and thaw them, put them in the oven, and you've got fresh, hot scones.
And my fear with scones, and I've made them this way, and I have had other scones, that they end up a little drier than mm-hmm. I'd like. And it's, how do we make sure that scones don't get too dry?
Great question. And they get a bad rap, I think. People think of scones as being dry. What you want to do, the main thing on that, is not to overmix your dough. So you're going to cut your butter into your sugar and flour, cut it in like if you were, well, I was going to say if you were doing a pie crust, but you don't do pie crusts. So.
but I've cut butter.
Cutting your butter into your flour so that all your little pieces of butter are coated with flour. This is then going to melt, and the steam is what creates all the little pockets in your scones. So you've got this all put together first. Then you're just going to throw your cream in at the end and just kind of quickly toss it together just until it holds together. And I think the biggest thing is people overmix things, and then the flour starts, the gluten starts to develop, and that's what causes it to be tough.
We've got your basic scone recipe at WPR.org, and in the recipe you talk about some changes to make if we want to do savory scones as opposed to sweet scones. What kind of things change when we're doing non-sweetened scones?
Basically just leaving the sugar out, and you can add herbs or garlic powder, onion powder, pretty much anything you want. Cheese, of course. You want cheese.
Right. So where does the cheese go in? Is it just stirred in and mixed throughout, or put on top and melted at the end? How do we add the cheese?
That's a great question. And it's the same thing when you're adding anything else to the scone mixture, is after I have it all ready, all the flour cut in and mixed together, just before I add my cream is when I toss in my extra ingredients. So that way you don't have to mix it more after you add that in.
Oh, okay. So, and that's going to prevent that gluten developing and prevent it from drying out.
Right.
Because we don't have that extra stirring stage.
And also when you're baking them, they're going to continue baking. The residual heat is going to finish off the baking process. So you're going to pull them when they're just nice and golden brown, but not overdone, because they're going to keep baking in the center a little bit more after they come out of the oven.
And are they like bread where you're not supposed to cut into them when they're still steaming hot? Because they're still baking, like you say.
Well, yeah. Maybe a few minutes.
Okay, because it's hard to resist. Yeah.
Yeah. They're definitely best warm. They're also definitely best the day they're made. So if you're going to use them on another day, I would say either make them and freeze them and in order to bake them fresh, or freeze them right away after they're baked. And you're still going to lose a little bit there, but definitely you don't want to leave them sitting out.
And we've covered the recipes you shared with us. We have them all at WPR.org/Food Friday. And you say these are all pretty easy. Now, if there's somebody out there who's like, yeah, I do all that, what's a good next level thing for somebody who wants to try something a little bit more complicated, just in our last few moments?
You mean a different type of dessert?
Yeah.
Oh, I love doing cheesecakes. And there's just a little bit of things that you have to be more careful of with that you don't get the oven too hot and that it doesn't crack, and controlling the heat, controlling the time. But there again, you can use the same crust that we just talked about, bake it off, and then make your cheesecake, put it in there, top it with anything you want, and there too then you can get lots of different desserts out of one basic batch.
Fantastic. Susan, thanks a lot for joining us. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you. It has.
Susan Feast is a pastry chef. She owns and operates Sweet Feast, dessert catering, and is a baking instructor in the culinary arts program at Madison College. She joined us in the studio today to talk about some sweet treats to make during this holiday season. You can find the recipes she shared with us at WPR.org/Food Friday. We had the scones, the chocolate ganache and truffles, and that chocolate tart. Again, all at WPR.org/Food Friday.